Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and tonight we're discussing divination for magicians. Now, we're qualifying this subject to exclude a number of techniques not often used in magic, and we will lead off with the tarot, discussing the actual origins of the tarot, the 19th century Egyptian origin myth, how it was thought to be older than the Kabbalah, and its subsequent influence on the modern Hermetic Kabbalah. We'll go from Eliphas Levi through Paul Foster Case and on to Crowley, and we'll discuss various tarot designs and their particular attributes. Now then, we'll move on to geomancy, discussing its ancient origins and its characteristics, and we'll briefly compare it to the Chinese I Ching. Now, tonight we'll be taking calls on this subject, so join us and see what the future holds in store. By the way, that guest call-in number is area code 347-857-1830. I'll repeat that. 347-857-1830. So give us a call at any time, and just keep on topic here, if you will, and fairly brief, and we'll try to answer your questions. And so, with that said, let's get right on into it. Now, perhaps dispel some myths about the tarot. At the same time, we don't want to demystify it, because it's still, regardless of what myths we might discredit here, the tarot is a very, very powerful and a very mysterious and a very deeply I use the word supernatural. We can call it that, because the tarot has a marvelous quality to reveal yourself and to reveal the future, what the future holds for you, what the past has led you to. It's a marvelous tool, and so if it has acquired some glamour, let's try to retain the glamour. I think we can. And still, at the same time, let's put it in proper perspective. Now, the tarot, as it developed in late medieval Europe, the tarot is a combination of two elements. The Italian Renaissance Tarucci deck, and I think most of you have seen that those are. Those are rather tall, skinny cards, and they look very Renaissance-ish. They're the court cards, and then the number cards, the letter cards, were developed from the Mamluk deck, which was Turkish. Now the Mamluk deck may have come along a little earlier than the Tarucci deck over in Italy, but the Mamluk deck was added to the Tarucci deck after 1400s. And so you ended up with a pack of cards The reason why now, the reason why we know that the minor cards came from the Mamluk deck. You can see those paddles. If you look at the Marseille deck, you can see those paddles in the so-called club suits or one suits. They're polo sticks. And I got a book from a friend of mine, Golden Dawn member over in Turkey. Book, a very scholarly book, published in Holland, by the way, on the Mamluk tarot. So this is pretty well established. So you have two sources there, the Tarucci cards for the majors and this Mamluk tarot for the minors. Now, this game, it was a game. It was a game, and you used to play for recreation, gambling, and whatever. It didn't have any particular mystical or occult or fortune-telling significance until about 1781, a French occult dilettante, Court de Gebelin, published a book in which he wrote an essay, and he had another essay, a similar essay from a friend of his, claiming that the tarot had an ancient Egyptian origin and that it was, in fact, a repository of symbolic occult secrets. Now, this came out in 1781. That's a little bit before the French Revolution. Now, after the French Revolution, a hairdresser who called himself Etiella, he took Court de Gebelin and his friend at their word, and he designed and took the old tarot and changed it around a bit, the images, and produced a beautiful, beautiful deck. I have one of the copies of that old deck, or not that old, but I mean it's a modern reproduction of it. And in the 1800s, the very late 1700s, early 1800s, Etiella started producing these tarot decks for occult and for fortune telling and for occult contemplation. So these decks were not Kabbalistic. They were more some sort of a very romanticized hermetic idea. And now here's where we start getting into the occult or magician's tarot. Then in the 1860s, Alphonse Constant, otherwise and more popularly known as Eliphas Levi, the reinventor of Renaissance occultism. In other words, Eliphas Levi took Agrippa and really romanticized Agrippa. Eliphas Levi, in the 1860s, developed the idea, which of course goes back to what Court de Gebelin had said, that the tarot was ancient Egyptian, that it was really, really ancient, and ancient Hebrew, and that from the tarot, this is Levi's central idea here, from the tarot, the Kabbalah arose. Now, this is very important. This is not true, by the way. This is not the case. But Levi had this idea, and very strongly. And he wrote a book on it called The Sanctum Regnum. And he wrote another book that hasn't been published yet on this. He firmly believed this. This was the great secret. This is where the tarot preceded the Kabbalah, according to Levi. Now, Levi had a student, Paul Christian. Now, Paul Christian, in 1870, Paul Christian decided that he took Levi at his word, and he decided that he would write a book in which he would go Levi even one better, and he would take the tarot cards and make them initiatory and have them down in the Great Pyramid and have a lion, and the candidate was taken in Paul Christian's version of the Kratoropoeia, by the way. Paul Christian borrowed the Kratoropoeia from Germany And that was, you know, came around about 1775. So he borrowed that niche story system, squeezed it all up into one degree, to all 7 degrees, romanticized a bit, added a few more things to it, and then had all these tarot cards, all 22 of them, attributed to his coded version of the Hebrew alphabet, which he called the alphabet of the Magi, and they were all in this dim-lit corridor in the Great Pyramid where the initiate would be taken by torchlight and shown these designs and given their esoteric significance as initiatory. Now, there are a couple of places in the Crater of Poa that something like this is indicated. Not quite as romantically as Paul Christian put it out. Paul Christian went further. He said that the Iamblichus, the Neoplatonic philosopher in the early centuries after Christ, he was a pagan philosopher, a Neoplatonic philosopher and a magician, that the Iamblichus had been responsible for these cards, for these designs. So he really, Paul Christian trumped, he trumped even Court de Gebelin and Levy with this idea. And so, and of course, when I was naive and back in the 1970, I read Paul Christian's book, and oh boy, well, actually, I had read it a little earlier than that. I think I read it in 69. And oh, I just thought, well, gosh, no, the Iamblichus, wow, you know. And so I was caught up in the romance of this. Now, this in turn, this idea that Paul Christian had influenced Kenneth McKenzie, who very, and influenced him very quickly too. It couldn't have been more than a little while after Christian published this that McKenzie wrote the cipher manuscript for the Golden Dawn, and then Mathers got a hold of that after McKenzie died, and Mathers decided that, oh yes, we got to use the tarot cards for initiations, and Mathers adopted Levy's, which Christian had also adopted Levy's system, except he made two changes that were very significant. One change that he made that were very significant is he moved the Fool from the bottom of the deck up to the top of the deck. Marvelous idea. And then he realized that once he hit the number system set up and all the way the paths, all the astrological attributes on the paths, that it would be necessary to have strength, the tarot card strength, would certainly be attributed to Leo. So he moved that to Leo, and then he took Justice and moved that down to Libra, where the scales, where that ought to be. So that rectified the whole thing, and that became the Golden Dawn scheme. Now, this, of course, is on the Tree of Life, and this is the Tree of Life as defined by the Sefer Yetzirah alphabet. And as you know, as we mentioned before, that the Hebrew alphabet, the astrological attributes, the planetary attributes, and the elemental attributes to the letters of the alphabet, this is one of the most important correspondences in magic. And so you can relate this to the tarot. You can relate it to any number of other correspondences. It gives you a whole string of correspondences to use for formulas and what have you. So it's very important. Now, that, in a sense, completed the esoteric connection of the tarot in about 1887, something like that. We had that fixed, and that stayed pretty much that way ever since. Crowley diddled around a little bit with it. He had to kind of diddle and make a little change. I made a little change myself later on that I'll talk about. But essentially this is where it ended up. This is how it got that way. Now, you may ask, what does this have to do with divination? Well, it has a lot to do with divination, because you can take the tarot. Paul Christian, by the way, did this first, and Mathers copied him. You can apply these cards to astrology, to the heavens. You can apply them to the decans of the zodiac. They can be set up in any occult correspondence. You can apply a tarot card to it. And so certainly, if you're going to in divination, your divinations can be, in this case, very complex, and they can be very deep. So certainly, these astrological and Kabbalistic correspondences are very important to divination, or at least for a magician. Now, the next thing we should move to, of course, is Paul Foster Case. And this is in the 1920s. Now Paul Foster Case, he took Levy's idea that the tarot preceded the Kabbalah and the tarot inspired the Kabbalah. Case took that idea and made it his central theme in his work. And so he developed, he went further and he rejected the Enochian system, by the way, the Golden Dawn. He developed a set of tablets in Hebrew that did this somewhat similar to the Enochian. But Paul Case was completely enamored of and focused on the tarot primarily. Now, this, in my opinion, was good in one way, and because it made him one of the greatest tarot masters the world's ever seen, and his Book of Tokens is wonderful, and his whole course on tarot is wonderful, and he used his deck is very much inspired by the Waite, by the Arthur Edward Waite Pamela Smith deck, but which I'll get into in a minute. But Paul Case, the problem, of course, with both Levy and Case in this idea that the tarot precedes the Kabbalah is that it tended to skew their philosophical orientation a bit, to the point where they found themselves following the paths became more important than the spheres in their philosophy, and they ended up with a psychic center system, or a chakra system, that was not as elegant as perhaps it should have been. That's my opinion now. It's just my opinion. I understand. Had they not been so tarot fixated, they could have probably looked and seen the spheres and the lightning flash and the sequence. They probably would have said, "Aha! You know, this is the way it ought to be, because you come down through the spheres and you go back up through the spheres, and that's Hermetic philosophy, that's Orphic philosophy, that's the great Western philosophy. So why are we diddling around with all these chakras in different places, upside down and inside out, and whatever?" I think that perhaps in that sense, that was not a good thing. But in any other way, I think that the tarot is so important to the Hermetic Kabbalah. Now, the rabbis won't have anything to do with it. In other words, the tarot has no place in Hebrew Kabbalah, as far as they're concerned, in Kabbalah, and that's spelled with a K. Our Kabbalah is most often spelled with a Q. You know, Kubala, and they've got Kabbalah, and we have Kubala, but ours, Otero figures very, very heavily as a result of Levy and Case in our system, and Christian too. Now, that said, let's take a look at Arthur Edward Waite and the Pamela Smith deck, because I happen to be very fond of that deck, and I use it for personal divination all the time. And I think it's probably just for personal divination, without getting into doing big Tree of Life readings and things like this. I prefer the Pamela Smith, the Pamela Smith, Arthur Edward Waite deck. Let me talk about that for a minute. Waite was a very good scholar. He's very hard to read. He's almost impossible to read. He's a wonderful translator, and a very, very good good scholar. And he was a member of the Golden Dawn, and he and William Butler Yeats, they had a falling out because Waite, curiously enough, Waite didn't want to have any examinations between grades. He wanted to make the Golden Dawn just a mystical thing and do everything with the initiations and whatever, not have these examinations. I don't know quite why he was that way, but anyway, that's the way he was. And so they had a falling out. Anyway, Waite started his own Golden Dawn type organization and developed his own tarot deck. And he has an esoteric tarot deck. And then he decided that he got his artist, Pamela Smith, and he decided that he would do a tarot that would be available for non-initiates. And so he and this really, really talented young woman, Pamela Smith, they got together and they did this, what's called the Rider Pack. Now, the Rider Pack I think, as I say, it's just a beautiful deck. And its symbolism is wonderful. And, of course, Paul Foster Case loved it. He virtually copied it. You know, he had it redrawn, but it was the same, essentially same designs. And it's pretty close to the traditional designs, except they're much better. Now, Arthur Edward Waite, although he also had an esoteric deck, which is much more it's Art Nouveau. It's very Art Nouveau, and Pamela Smith's deck is kind of Art Nouveau, but this esoteric deck of Waite's is called Waite's Second Tarot, this is very, very Art Nouveau. Now, if you want to take a look at the Waite, most people have never seen this Waite deck, the second Waite deck. I'd like to mention a book here on all the subject that we're covering. It's called A History of the Occult Tarot, 1870-1970. It's by Ronald Decker and Michael Dummett. Dummett, that's spelled D-U-M-M-E-T-T. Now, these two gentlemen have written this book, came out in 2002. This is a scholarly, in-depth history of everything we've been talking about. And they have beautiful reproduction in here, in black and white, of course, of the Waite, of some of the trumps from the Waite deck in here, along with, you know, some Crowley, and they have a representation of all of the major decks in here. But you get to see this Waite tarot, this esoteric Waite tarot. Now, that's a book that I recommend, even though I will say that we are cited in that book, our Secrets of the Golden Dawn Cipher manuscript, of course, is mentioned several times in that book, obviously because we have a breakdown of the Golden Dawn Tarot, and so that's one reason why I'm suggesting the book, but then on the other hand, I think it's about the best one out there on that subject. Now, let's talk about Aleister Crowley's Book of Thoth for a bit. Aleister Crowley decided in the 1930s that he would do a tarot, and he commissioned Freda Harris, who was an artist who was up with a bit of cubism and surrealism, and she was marvelously competent. And she and Crowley developed a rapport on this, and Crowley had an advantage with this deck, and hardly anybody knows this. But you're going to realize once I tell you. You're going to realize, and you look at the deck, you're going to realize what's going on here. Crowley Having been a Golden Dawn initiate, Inner Order initiate, Crowley knew. He knew how those cards should be colored. He knew the formula was the Minutum Mundum, that's the tree of life that's made up with paths on the king scale and spheres on the queen scale, all in color, and Crowley knew that the cards should be, never attributed to the paths, of course, that the cards should be the colors of the paths they were attributed to and the spheres they were going to. That was the color key to make this deck fit on the tree of life perfectly. And they did it that way. And if you compare the Thoth deck, you compare the Crowley and Harris Thoth deck with some of these Golden Dawn decks that where the artists did not know this and did not know how to do this, you will immediately see one of the reasons why, aside from Frieda's beautiful artwork, you'll see one of the reasons why the Crowley deck has that power, how it just you just know it's right. Whereas you look at some of these Golden Dawn decks where they don't know this, and you think, it's just somehow it just doesn't go together. So this is a little secret that we need to look at. Someday somebody's going to do a Golden Dawn deck on this formula. I learned this from Pat Zaleski, by the way, because I think Pat wanted me to do a Golden Dawn deck that way, and I wish I had the time to do that. Now. Crowley, the only change Crowley made, really, was he reversed the Emperor and the Star. And he had a rationale in that, aside from Iwas and the Book of the Law telling me he's supposed to do it. But you can loop it around the Zodiac. It's kind of a change-off on the Zodiac. Now, one of the problems with the Thoth deck, or two problems with it, the first problem is the cards when they were produced were too big for comfortable regular fortune telling. You can't shuffle them very well. They're too big. Now they're wonderful for meditation, wonderful for use in magical rituals and all that, being a large size. In fact, I'd like an even larger size for that. But until recently, we haven't had a shuffleable, an actual kind of top-of-the-table usable Crowley deck until now we do have. So those of you who want a new regular-style divination with the Crowley deck, yep, you can do it. Now, the other problem is that Crowley's deck, Crowley's directions in the Book of Thoth for divination are not that comfortable. And they're just not compared to the directions for using the Rider Pack for fortune telling, if you will, for using it for fortune. They're just not that comfortable. And they're now both Lon Duquette let's see, this lady's name. Angelis Arian, the Tarot Handbook, Practical Application of Ancient Visual Symbols. Big, great, big, great, big coffee table book on this. Both Angelis Arian, she has an MA in Anthro, and Lon Duquette, both of them have written books making the Crowley deck more user-friendly for divination. So I'm not going to say it can't be done, but I'm going to say that if you look at the Book of Thoth itself, it's not comfortable. So that's one of the drawbacks, but otherwise, it's a great deck. Now, that pretty much brings us up to the present time, because I don't think, there must be at least 5,000 tarot decks for sale out there, more, maybe probably more. I've got 7,000 that you can order on the internet right now. And everybody and his brother has come up with a tarot deck. And not that they shouldn't. I mean, that's fine. They can do that. Tarot is a very personal thing. But I think really, when we get up to the Crowley Harris deck, I think we've just about hit the high water mark for occult tarot. Now, that said, let me reach over here if I can and get the the red ray, which is the last seventh ray we published. We got the green ray coming up, but I keep saying. But this this came out in 2000. Now, what I did, my small contribution to taroting, in both in the Golden Dawn and in our Craterapoa upper order, inner order, what we both have an 11 sphere tree. Now, the Golden Dawn's 11 sphere tree, and I think many of you have seen this in the Cypher manuscript, the Golden Dawn's 11 sphere tree is an Isaac Luria design, which has, you know, all 11 spheres on it and whatever. But you have to change everything around. All the cards got to be changed around. You know, there's a reason for that. But then on the other hand, here the candidate goes working his or her way up through the path workings and all the paths down below where we're using the tarot cards as symbols and as astral doorways, and we're using them for all these things. And then you ask them when they get in the inner order, you ask them to throw all that away and then start over again with something else. I don't know. I thought that wasn't such a good idea. So what I did with the 11 sphere tree that we have, what I did was I took the more comfortable expedient of adding, of putting, of activating the Hoth, and then creating three more paths. Because what happens when you do that, of course, is you have to split the path down the middle. It goes through to Hoth, and in the regular tree, it goes the Kircher tree. It goes right up through, and you've got the High Priestess, and you split that with Hoth, so you've got one going in and then one going on up. And so I rearranged the top, and I won't get into all how that. It's done, but it's done a minimal of rearrangement. Kether becomes zero instead of one. Hokma becomes one, and then Bina becomes two. It's the realm of the fixed stars, where it should be in Bria. It never should have been Saturn. Not the way the concept is. It's the realm of the. It should be the realm of the fixed stars, and then we move Saturn down to Da'ath, which is three, where it should be. So we aren't changing the numbers at all. And then the rest of it, Hesed and Gevurah and Tiferet, they're all the same. However, what we end up with is a new path leading from Gevurah to Da'ath, a path leading from Hesed to Da'ath, and a path leading from Tiferet to Da'ath. So I have three cards, new cards, which I have in full color in the red ray, and the paths all diagrammed and everything else. Those of you who have the red ray, you can look at these and you see how they work out. They're all laid out according to our 24 letter alphabet, Phoenician alphabet, which has Omega as a final and Krater as zero. So it's a rather elegant system, and that's my little contribution. I decided that trying to change the tarot that we all study and love and all that in the bottom is not a good idea. But adding the cards, I was more than willing to do that. So essentially, I think just about covers our tarot discussion for tonight. Remember, now you want to call in. If you want to call in, and you can still talk about tarot. I'm going to go on into geomancy, but The call-in number is area code 347-857-1830. Now, let's talk about geomancy. Now, you know, a lot of people don't even know what geomancy is, or if they do, they think it's going out and measuring the Earth. It does refer, geomancy, of course, does refer to the Earth. Now, geomancy is a binary system. Now, what we've got with geomancy, it's very elegant, and frankly, its origins are so old that it's almost kind of scary. I believe, and I think that there's some justification for this, that this system in its, at least in some form or other, this system goes back to the Paleolithic. And it, and we'll get into that in a minute. But what it is, it's a binary system, very much like the I Ching. It has a lot of similarities to the Chinese I Ching. By the way, Crowley didn't like the tarot so much for divination. He was an I Ching aficionado. He really, really liked the I Ching. And, of course, old Lou Culling, liked the I Ching, too. And they both wrote books about it. I don't warm up to the I Ching. I decided that I was going to see if I couldn't get more into geomancy because it was more Western. And because other people had kind of, they kind of walked away from it. The only thing they learned about it was so they could use it for talismans. But geomancy is very powerful. It's ferociously, I got a call. Oh, hi, this is the Hermetic Hour. You're on the air. Who am I talking to?
Hi, I go by the name of Mother Macabre, but my name is Catherine. And my question is, I'm very interested in the colors that you were talking about that Crowley used for his Thoth deck. And I was wondering if there was some place that I could learn about those, or if I would have to be initiated into the Golden Dawn.
No, you don't. I'm sure the Golden Dawn would maybe like it that way, but the plain fact of the matter is that Minutum Mundum diagram, which is the key to that, has been published numerous places. I think it's even Ophiel's got it in his books, and it's in the Golden Dawn. You know, the Golden Dawn book itself. Now, the way it works is they created this. The Tree of Life has four color scales. Now, it has four color scales. Yeah, it has four color scales. So you can have a tree in each one of these color scales, and you can do it with paths and spheres together or whatever. So what they did was they made a composite. They liked the idea of the paths being the king scale active, and that the spheres being the queen scale, which they considered passive. This was a rationale that they came up with. So they created a color design called the Minutum Mundum.
Okay.
Now, when you go to this, I would get the sixth edition of the Golden Dawn, because that's the one with the index.
Okay.
You don't get a Golden Dawn without an index. That's like getting a horse without a saddle. get a sixth edition of the Golden Dawn big paperback with that Minutum Mundum. Get in there and study that thing and look at the Thoth deck. Get it out and the attributes and everything, and lay it out there and look at where those cards go, and then start looking at the paths and the spheres.
Okay.
The path that the card goes on, and because the cards, you know, the trumps, they all go on the sphere. Now, also, too, you need to know that rest of this now. The Golden Dawn attributed they attributed all the tarot cards, all 78 of them. They attributed them to each of the spheres and the whole business. And so you need to get their scheme, and they've got it in there. And you can just look and you can see how those cards were colored.
Great. Okay. That would be very interesting. I'm going to do that.
Well, actually, you know, Pat Zaleski, one evening when we were having a skull session, Pat Zaleski just, he wanted me to do a real Golden Dawn tarot deck. He really wanted me to. I'm something of an artist. I know, you know, claim I'm not good, but he wanted me to, and he told me this, and I've seen all these Golden Dawn decks, and I haven't seen one of them that. And he said that Crowley and Harris that they knew how to do it, and then he told me how to do it because he wanted me to do it. So now I'm telling you how to do it, so you do it.
Excellent. I will. I have one other question. If you're not too, I know you're. Well,
yeah,
I got a little time.
That's
all right. It's probably too involved. That's all right. But I appreciate your answer very much. Thank you.
Okay. Good luck.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye bye.
Okay, now let's get back to geomancy. Now, geomancy is a binary, and like the I Ching, it is really, really ancient, and I'm going to explain why it's that ancient in a minute. Now, we got it originally, like we get almost everything else in Renaissance Hermetic occultism, the whole Hermetic thing, too, we got from the Arabs, okay? So geomancy came on through from the Arabs in the Middle Ages. You even find that geomancy sneaks its way into the Parzival by Wolfram von Essenbach. Oh yeah, and that's in Spain with the Grail down there in the Pyrenees, and oh boy. So this geomancy system is very old, and it, by the way, in West Africa. They have it in West Africa. They call it the Oracle of Fna, and so the West Africans do it. And they have for hundreds and hundreds of years. We don't know how far back that goes. Now here is the geomancy. By the way, has 16 characters. These 16 characters have four ranks of two dots each, and they're different configurations. Every possible configuration that you can get one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Every possible combination of these of this grid that you can come up with in 16, you get 16 possible permutations. This is very ingenious. Each one of these characters represents a special configuration of what amounts to eight dots. And so you have a very elegant little system for 16 different characters. Now, they relate this to astrology, and they relate, and so consequently, geomancy is very, very much an astrological system. Remember now, these ancient horoscopes were square. That's an important thing to remember. So a geomantic reading will take you through the whole horoscope, and it will relate to the whole horoscope. And so you can see that it certainly has, each one of these characters certainly has magical significance and hermetic significance. Now, the method for doing this divination, this casting or this whatever, is really something that got lost. And so we ended up in the Golden Dawn with taking a pencil. If you can imagine this, how clumsy and bad this was. Taking a pencil, making a bunch of dots on a paper, and then counting up the dots. Or taking a pair of dice and rolling them and getting a yes or no answer, you know. Or doing something, then supposedly sticking a stick in a box of sand. All of these things were, I believe, not what was really done. I think what was really done was this, and this is my own idea, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. The ancient dice, way back in the before the first century, ancient dice were called astraea, and that means of the stars. Okay, that was the first dice were made from the huckle bones of split foot animals. Now these huckle bones are little. They're like little ball bearings that are in each of the ankles of split foot animals. So you kill an animal, you know, back in the Paleolithic, the hunter goes out, he kills a deer, and one of the things, he gives the feet to the shaman. And every, you know, mama gets to cook the rest of it, and the boys get to eat it, but the shaman gets the feet. Why? Because the shaman wants the huckles. So the shaman takes the huckle, and the huckle is like a little ball bearing. It has a round top and a round bottom, and it has four little dished out sides. So the shaman takes his four huckles, cleans them off, and puts his geometric figures on them, and he's got 16 of these figures, and they're exactly what he's going to do because they're the perfect dots. So these are the original bones. So when you do a geometric reading, you throw the bones, and this is very shamanic and very ancient. Now, there is another ancient method of geomancy, and that is the Urim and the Tulum on the breastplate of the high priest of the temple. And this was probably fluorite crystals. Now, fluorite crystals form, there are two of them, one on each side, they're stone, and they are native to Israel in that area. And they have, they're truncated, or they're not truncated, they're pyramid, they're two-ended pyramids. They're four, you know, eight sides, two stones, two eight-sided pyramids. You can put your geometric characters on either one of them, and then you can roll them. Now, thing is, we tried this, and of course, they work, but the problem is fluorite crystals are fragile. So you have to roll them on a deer hide, and you shouldn't be doing this more than once or twice a year, or you're going to need new fluorite crystals. Well, that's all right. I mean, you're only going to do this. The priests only did this just on rare occasions. But they're perfect for it, and they are stone. So and of course this, as I say, is a very good. Now both the Astraea and the fluorite, that's both things we've come up with. Where I'm virtually certain we're right, though. I don't know about the fluorite, but I'm positive on the huckles. Now and also too, I had a friend of mine in Iraq. He got in with the Yazidis, and he told me that the Yazidis were doing something very similar. Now, let's talk about the geomantic readings, and there's the problem. Now, all of this is great, and it makes you want to go learn geomancy and everything else. By the way, Stephen Skinner has a great book. I think he's got about the best handbook on geomancy going. So if you want to get a handbook on geomancy, he doesn't have my huckles and my fluorite and our Rillum and Tulum in there, but you can get that you can get in the Blu-ray. We have an extensive article on this in the Blu-ray, so you can get that, and that'll teach you how to do huckles. By the way, on huckles, if you want huckles, it's going to be real hard to get them, and the reason is that once those deer feet are cut off, they harden up to such a point, all those tendons harden up to such a point, if you don't get those huckles out when the deer is still warm, you're probably not going to be able to get them. That's why they're real hard to get. I think you can find them on the internet, though, but they've got to be huckles for split foot animals. Okay, so that's that, but the problem with geomancy is not that it isn't accurate. It is ferociously accurate. I mean, it is detailed, and you get a whole full horoscope, the whole round of everything in the all your houses and everything applying to the question, and so you get a really in-depth reading and whatever. Here's the problem, though. Geomancy has not been modified since the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages, actually. It hasn't been modified since the Dark Ages. It has not gone through the softening and the comforting process that natal astrology has gone through, or that tarot has gone through. And I'm not even going to say I Ching, because I Ching we're not discussing I Ching so much tonight, except to compare it as a binary. But the problem with geomancy is, as I say, it has not been modified. The results of the various figures in the various houses, the results that you're getting, has not been modified, has not been made more comfortable since the Dark Ages, and therefore, the answers that geomancy gives you can be nasty, brutish, and short, because that's the way life was in the Dark Ages, nasty, brutish, and short. And that's why I don't like to do geomancy unless the issue is very important. And I want an absolutely no unvarnished answer. Then I'll do it. And so, but you should once a year set up. And we have an altar top geomancy board with walls around the side, like a magical crap table. And what we do is we shake the bones in a cup, and we circumambulate. And we do it ceremonially, and then cast the bones on the top of the altar in the horoscope pattern. And then the scribe indicates which one of the die hits either the huckle. Now we have something like the Urim and the Tulum, except it's they're game dice that are the same as the Urim and the Tulum, but they're much more they're hard plastic, and they're much more durable than the Urim and the Tulum. So then the scribe goes around and he marks Albus in the third house, and then he writes it down. Then we go shaking and going around again, and we go invoking the spirit, the spirit of Mars or the spirit of whatever planet we're doing, and then we throw them again. And it's a very good ceremony, you have to really be doing it for an important purpose, because if there's anything bad going to happen, it'll sure tell you. So these geomantic characters figure in sigils, they figure in talismans. We use them in correspondences. The 16 gates of the Parseval, of the Lotus. Of the Petalmund city in the Parseval has 16 gates, and that applies to the geomantic characters. They have a lot of significance in Hermetic symbolism, and correspondences. And the binary aspect of geomancy is, the whole universe is a binary. God is a binary. Everything is a binary, so this is getting right down to the most basic that you can possibly get to. It's why the I Ching is also so powerful. Now, next week we're going to deal with creative visualization, and that will be another one of our in-depth topics on that, how to do it, and we'll go moving from Barton and discussing Barton's methods, improvements on Barton, Bill Gray's ideas. Some of Walter Atkinson's ideas weren't too bad either, and that was William Walter Atkinson wrote under the name of Ramacharaka, if those of you remember that. Now, on the tarot, to summarize, that Eliphas Levy in the 1860s, the French occultist, romantic, very, very romantic, he's the one who originally decided that the Kabbalah and the tarot that the tarot had actually given birth to the Kabbalah, and the two should be integrated. So it's we owe Eliphas Levi, as wrong as he might have been about that, he was right in one sense, because the tarot and the Kabbalah fit very well together. It's if they weren't together to begin with, then they certainly should have been. So and this gives us a dimension to the Hermetic Kabbalah that I think is delightful, and I think it's beautiful, and I think it's very profound. And so I'm I think it's something that some of our Hebrew Kabbalists,
I wish you had tarot cards. Lon Duquette, by the way, did this wonderful book called The Chicken Kabbalah of Rabbi Lament Ben Clifford, in which he took the persona of Rabbi Lament Ben Clifford, and he was going to have a Kabbalah for everybody. And so he said, oh, have as many tarot cards as you like. Go ahead. And I think that we really are fortunate to have the tarot integrated with our version of Kabbalah, because it really, really gives us a wonderful depth of power and sensitivity and feeling. It puts the heart, it puts the heart back into Kabbalah. It gives it heart. What was it old Don Juan Matus supposedly said? He said, you want to judge a path? He says, judge the path. Ask yourself, does the path have heart? Well, in this sense, the old Jewish philosophy was not to show images like this, not to see God or the angels in forms of images. And so they couldn't, they were really restricted to how much imagery they could really use. Christians, on the other hand, used a lot of imagery. So the people who developed this were nominally Christian, and so they could use the imagery. And so thank heaven for that, and unintended. Okay. Anyway, next week, creative visualization, and let's have some more calls. Meanwhile, good magic, and we'll see you next week.